did it before. Yeah. So this morning we are on Gospel of Matthew 10, chapter 10, and we've got all sorts of. Did I say Matthew?
Yeah.
Sorry, Mark. Matthew's on my mind though, because probably if you have your a Bible handy and not just your Mark, you probably want to slip a finger over in Matthew 19. Because this discussion of marriage, which happens at the beginning of Mark 10, takes place at the beginning of Matthew 19. And where is it? It's Matthew, I remember. Oh, Matthew 19:10. After he gives the teaching on the indissolubility of marriage. Remember, the apostles respond, 19:10, if such is the case of a man with his wife, it's not expedient to marry. Okay, if marriage truly is unbreakable, then it's not expedient to marry. I start with that because, by coincidence, this week is the beginning of the marriage and family unit in moral theology. And the moment that you go through, I will talk about divorce. The first thing I have to make clear to them is, for us, we will lump all sorts of things together as divorce that are very different situations. Namely, annulment, that it never was a marriage in the first place. There are all sorts of examples I give, but an easy one is, what if Princess Leia actually married Luke Skywalker? Okay. Well, they can't marry because of consanguinity. So they could attempt marriage, but it wouldn't be a real marriage. I give them different scenarios for that. Legal separation. We're just going to call that divorce. But you could have people who separate because of some moral problem with the other spouse. And again, the example I give is, let's say I go home and I find that Mrs. Hippler is carving squares out of the carpet and eating them. Carpet! Delicious! Yummy! Okay, we're going to find a very, very nice place, very nice people to take care of Mrs. Hippler. And we're going to have, I'm going to have custody of the children, I'm going to have care of the finances. But if we're validly married, I'm not going to be free to remarry, right? If there's nothing wrong with our vows, then it's still a real marriage, even if Mrs. Hippler has gone bananas. Finally, in the third situation would be where you have people who are validly married. There's nothing wrong with their vows. It was free and informed consent. They were of age. There was no problem of consanguinity. None of that. They are now attempting to end a valid marriage for the sake of remarriage. They're attempting to end a valid marriage for the sake of remarriage. That is the situation that when we say the Catholic Church doesn't approve of divorce, and that's what we're describing. We're not describing something that wasn't a marriage in the first place. We're not describing people who are physically splitting because of some kind of moral, physical problem, insanity, drug abuse, physical abuse. We're not describing that. But the attempt to end a vow in marriage for the sake of remarriage. Oh, go ahead. My students will ask about arranged marriage, and from their point of view, arranged marriage would be invalid just by the very fact that it's arranged. And I point out to them, first, your picture of arranged marriage is like Princess Buttercup marrying the evil Prince Humperdinck. You have this picture of arranged marriage out of your sort of comic or dramatic renditions in the Middle Ages. If you want, I have a link on the Moodle site for them. There have been over the years a number of articles in the Star Tribune talking about the immigrant Hindi community, right? Indians, East Indians, who are still going with who are still using forms of arranged marriage. And And they talk about the strengths and weaknesses of that system. But one of the things that you got to stop, I tell students, you got to stop watching like Princess Bride and watch some Bollywood movies or Hollywood movies. Because one I think of in particular, Hum Dil De Chuka Sanam, which is straight from the heart is how you render that in English. It has the very lovely Aishwarya Rai, who's often described as the most beautiful woman in the world. So that's a selling point. Mm-hmm. If you're going to get these guys into chick flicks, you got to throw them a bone. But the premise of them. Oh, by the way, and if you don't know this already, if you're going to watch a Bollywood or Hollywood movie, it's going to be 3 hours long, and there's going to be a lot of singing and dancing. So if you aren't into musicals as well, then this isn't for you. Or broaden your horizons, broaden your perspective. In any event, the plot of Hum Dil De Chuka Sanam is that Aishwarya Rai is arranged to marry this guy, and the family wishes it. She goes along with it, but she's actually in love with this other guy who's, you know, kind of charming but a little unstable. And her husband realizes this and says, you know what, if you truly love this guy, then I will help you, you know, find him and I'll hand you over to him. And so they have to go to Europe because this guy that she's in love with is this kind of egocentric opera singer type. And on the way of tracking down this guy she thinks she's in love with, she falls in love with her husband. Oh. Yeah, exactly. So arranged marriage always, I shouldn't say always, more often than not, involve the consent of the spouses. Involve the consent of the parties. If you're the parents of a daughter or a son, you want them to marry well, but you don't want them to shove a choice on them that somehow they'd be unhappy with. So likewise, at this time, it's not, you know, are there people who are being pressured into marriages simply because it's a family union? Yeah. But the way that I put it to them, what if your parents chose somebody for you who was like completely hunkalicious? Are you just going to sit there and fight it on principle? No, give me that ugly, dim-witted guy, just as long as he's my guy, you know, that I chose for myself. I don't tell them this, but I can tell you this, that my father, when I would bring girls home, he always could see the problems in those girls. He was always very polite and very civil. But son, what are you seeing in this girl? Well, gee, Dad, right, blah, 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 blah. And he said, son, if you keep going out with her, the following things are going to happen. Oh, he was always right. He was always right. So even as a dim-witted, you know, 16-year-old or 18-year-old, I had the sense that my father would probably choose better for me than I would ever choose for myself.
Did he truly react like that, going like this?
Oh, yeah. Some of them he was positively distressed. I did not, please don't get the wrong impression, I didn't go out with girls of sort of low moral character, but I was sort of attracted to neurotic girls. Now you can say that maybe all teenage girls are sort of neurotic, but I was sort of on the extreme end of that spectrum. There was just something irresistibly alluring about them to me that my father, oh my word, just taxed his patience. So please understand that in the milieu that we're dealing with here, yes, there are family expectations that are arranged, but you can't simply assume that this is against the will of the parties involved, nor can you assume that even if there is not an initial sort of romantic attraction, that there isn't a kind of a developed romantic attraction. It's a little more complicated than I think we think. Remember that for East Indians, there, and it comes up in these articles when you read them, they'll say, well, you know, you somehow don't like our system and you think yours is better. Look at your divorce rates. You're choosing people entirely on your own. There's no social pressure, and you guys can't stay married. Why do you think your system is so good? And what do we do? Blah, 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 right? I mean, it's good because it's ours. There was a Lutheran pastor, I heard this from one of my students years ago, her Lutheran pastor told her, it is better that you love the person that you marry than that you marry the person that you love. It's better that you love the person that you marry than you marry the person that you love. In other words, if you think of it in terms of some kind of like romantic storm, or and it wouldn't be a good choice unless some kind of romantic storm goes off. You know, that romantic storm might be about somebody who's a good idea for you to love, and it might not be. But however it is, it ends up that you live with that choice and you carry out that choice as best as you are able to. That's what we're all called to do. So the thing that my students are, I think, reacting to are the things that the apostles are reacting to. And it comes later. They're not understanding it. They're not seeing it. But remember, the indissolubility of marriage is related to marriage being a sacrament. And this is something that is a dividing line between, let's say, the Eastern Orthodox Roman Catholics and then the Protestant communions. So let's take a look at the text first, and then we'll talk about how it is that becomes an issue of controversy, you know, later on.
I should have put this an aside. At the Plymouth Movie Theater, they dedicate 2 or 3 screens to Bollywood movies all the time.
Oh my gosh, big screen Bollywood.
A huge population in Plymouth.
Yeah, and Maple Grove as well.
Yeah. I just thought that was interesting. So if you go over there, they're all in foreign languages.
See, this is your big opportunity.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Those Bollywood movies are out there for you. Again, you know, free up the afternoon, because it's going to be 3 hours. Their idea is if it's a movie that's worth watching, it's worth blocking out a whole afternoon for.
Bollywood.
I'm sorry?
Bollywood,
because that's centered in Bombay, which the Indians call Mumbai. But then there's also Kollywood, which is out of Kerala, which is in a different section of India. And remember, India has different, not just different languages, but even different language groups. So that's these movies, well, the Bollywood movies are in a different language from Kollywood movies. So that's why they're made in different parts of India and they're in different languages. They all have subtitles. But places like India, like the Philippines, really benefited by being taken over for a while by an English-speaking group, because that tended to shape their education, because it gave them a common language that all these different language groups could share. And to this day, public instruction in the Philippines is still in English, because you have these different language groups that don't want each other's languages. Somehow, if it's English, that's neutral. But don't impose the language from that island over here to us over here. And sometimes in India, you can have that attitude of don't impose your language from East India to us in Northern India or West India. It's a big place. So let's take a look at the text. Notice that verses 3 and 4, when you look in Mark, look how the conversation unfolds in Mark. He left there and went to the region of Judea and beyond the Jordan. The crowds gathered to him again, and again, as was his custom, he taught them. The Pharisees came up and, in order to test him, asked him, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife?" He answered them, "What did Moses command you?" They said, "Moses allowed a man to write a certificate of divorce and put her away." Jesus said to them, "For the hardness of your heart he wrote that commandment." Okay. And by the way, there's actually a term, sclerocardia. You know, literally, hardness of heart. It's one word in Greek, sclerocardia. And what does that mean? If you were not allowed to divorce your wives, then you would try to get out of marriage by killing them. Right? So this writ of divorce is to prevent uxoricide. Okay? I often have to tell students, when you think of divorce, your picture of divorce can often be this waif-like woman who's being dominated by this troglodyte of a husband, and now divorce allows this woman to get out of this right abusive or oppressive situation. Before the time of Christianity, divorce was a means for men to trade up. It was a way for you to, well, my grandfather's tasteless joke to my grandmother, "When you turn 40, can I trade you in for 2 20s? It's more like that. You got rid of your middle-aged, you know, wife at like 35 or 39, right? Your picture of her being middle-aged. And you trade up for somebody who's 18 or 19. That was what divorce tended to look like. It was not a means, in other words, for women to be able to get out of unjust or oppressive situations. It was a means for men to get younger women. Okay? So when Jesus forbids divorce, you have to remember that that, however strange it may sound, is immediately empowering to women. Because it means that you can't just get rid of your wife. You can't just write her a writ of divorce. And we're now beyond the point where somehow they've reached the point where they're not inclined to exorcise, where they're past that. Remember, we're talking about people who are still inclined at the time of Moses to idolatry and who fall into human sacrifice. So at the point where you're offering your own children in sacrifice, you know, killing your wife is not going to be something that's like beyond your, you know, oh, I'd sacrifice my child. I'd never kill my wife. You know, that's, you're talking about morally problematic people. But they're far enough along now that, as it were, God can say to them, I expect more of you. Okay, I expect more of you. Go ahead.
In the days of divorce, though, what would happen to the divorced woman? Did it mean like instant poverty and exclusion?
Yeah, often. Yeah, I mean, it depended. It depended. But no, that was to be cast off as a wife was always a problem. Yep. Yep. Hopefully you had relatives who might take care of you. But remember last year when we read Ruth and Naomi, that once Naomi's husband dies, that's like, they're done. I mean, she has no one to support her. She has to end up going back to her home country. Yeah. I flagged this line because when you read Matthew, the people, the Pharisees in Matthew, in that conversation, in verse 7 of Matthew, it's more... Well, look, let's hear it in Mark and then hear it in Matthew first. So Mark, which you have in front of you. Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife? He answered them, what did Moses command you? They said, Moses allowed a man to write a certificate of divorce, put her away. Jesus said to them, for the hardness of your heart you wrote that commandment. But from the beginning of creation God made them male and female. For this reason a man shall leave father and mother, join to his wife, and the two shall be one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What God has joined, let no man put asunder. Okay? When you hear it in Matthew, the Pharisees came up and tested him. Is it lawful for a man to divorce one's wife for any cause? He answered, have you not read from the beginning? Right? And then there's a beginning, the two shall be one flesh. Verse 7, then why did Moses command one to give a certificate of divorce and put her away? He said to them, for the hardness of your heart. Notice that they're responding to command. Why did Moses command? But there was nothing at the beginning about a command. When you read it in Mark, you realize the reason they're talking about a command is because Jesus said, what did Moses command? And then they answer that. So in a way, you have to put these two texts together and you get the complete conversation. Now, I highlight that not so much because of the doctrine, but again, the point that when you read things in different Gospels and they are different, you sort of expect that they're different. They shouldn't be identical. It's as if Mark reads what he sees in Matthew and remembers from Peter's relation to him, well, they brought up the command business because that's what Jesus asked them. What was the command? What did Moses command? Moses commanded a writ of divorce. So you put the two together, you get the complete conversation. The other bit that Mark adds, notice that after this exchange, in Matthew, after the exchange, the disciples immediately ask him, well, hey, if this is the law, then it's expedient for a man not to marry. But when you read it in Mark, when you read it in Mark, and in the house, the disciples asked him about the matter, and he said to them, whoever divorces, and so on. So they're not asking this in front of everybody. When you read it in Matthew, it sounds like he answers the Pharisees, and then immediately there are the apostles. Wouldn't it be? No, that's not what they do. Later on, after the apostles are alone with Jesus, now that's when they ask. He said to them, they asked him about the matter. He said, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. And if she divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery. Okay? You don't get the apostles' complaint, but you get one that they asked us privately, not in front of other people. And notice, if you compare it to Matthew 2, in Matthew, it's just he who divorces his wife if she divorces her husband and marries another, she's an adulteress. Here, it's more comprehensive. It's both husband and wife. So I think in Matthew, I'd have to look back again. I think it's the wife. But here, it's the husband and wife. Again, probably said the whole thing, but Matthew hits, as it were, certain points, and then Mark comes back and fills that out. Okay? In order to really completely understand this, in a way you have to understand how marriage is a sacrament. And that's not something that Jesus devotes time to. And that's why it is that marriage as a sacrament becomes controversial. Remember in the sort of break during the Protestant Reformation, what the Lutheran communions and those allied to them tended to feel more comfortable is where you have sort of explicit teaching on the sacrament from Jesus himself. Okay? So we have long explanations of baptism. We've got long explanations of Eucharist. But we do not have, we have this marriage being unbreakable, but we don't have the sacrament of marriage. If the person who fills that out is St. Paul in the letter to the Ephesians, where he talks about how it is that the union of man and woman is like the union of Christ and the church. If there's this supernatural or spiritual significance to the union of man and woman, then it makes all the sense in the world that it would be a sacrament. Remember that to say that something is a sacrament means that not just that it signifies something holy, but that somehow something is going to be brought about to affect what it signifies. So you're not just going to signify a union of man and woman in the order of grace, but God's assistance is going to work within that marriage such that they're able to live out a Christian life together. Now, if you deny that marriage is a sacrament, it seems to me it is very difficult at that point to insist on it being unbreakable. When you look at cultures all around the world, when you look at traditional cultures, they are going to try to keep people in stable marriages. They're going to discourage divorce as much as they can. And societies put a lot of energy into keeping people married because generally, there are all sorts of exceptions, but generally, it is the best for ensuring the welfare of the children. Remember that societies, as societies, don't care about romance. They don't care about flowers and chocolate and anniversary gifts. They don't care about that stuff. They care about all the stuff that comes after the cuddling, where you've got these little beings in the world that have to be taken care of. Because if you don't take care of them, then the larger society needs to step in at that point. And you can only have so much of that before it begins to break, before it strains the limits of what a society can do. So societies, when it comes to regulations of marriage and children, they don't think romantically. And this was very evident, by the way, in the debate about same-sex marriage. In a way, you had kind of the proponents of either side talking past each other, because the people who defended same-sex marriage had their strongest arguments when they were appealing to romance. How can love not be love, right? It was sort of, if you like, the kind of flowers and chocolate argument. Whereas people who were arguing from a non-religious standpoint were arguing on based on what society's interest in marriage and children are, which is the future of the society. One of the things that I've had some success with sophomores over the years, remember, and it's easy to forget, these children have grown up in a world in which there never was a ban on same-sex marriage. Same-sex marriage has been around as long as they've been alive. Okay? So it's like people like me who were born in the 1960s. I was born in the middle of the sexual revolution. So I have no experience of what the world was like before that. I think sometimes to the exasperation of my father, because he had the lived experience of this thing that now we ridicule as Ozzie and Harriet, Leave It to Beaver. We ridicule as this conformist world that existed up in the 1950s. So for our young people, when they see a teaching on marriage, they think fundamentally in terms of romance and romantic expression. And if you're going to talk about marriage in terms of the natural law, that is all about children and the future. And I was about to say, one argument that I've had some success with, when you look at the countries that have approved same-sex marriage, the thing that goes hand in hand with that is sub-replacement fertility. These are all countries that do not have enough children. They do not have enough children to replace themselves. Same-sex marriage doesn't cause that. Both of them are caused by the same thing, namely the belief that children are sort of a lifestyle option when it comes to human sexuality. Human sexuality is about all sorts of other things, and if you want it to be about children, knock yourself out. But it's not fundamentally about that. The moment a society makes that choice, it doesn't have enough children. And so what happens in the long run is you have larger and larger numbers of older people and smaller numbers of younger people to care for them. A stat that makes some impression on the students: by the year 2025, China will have a quarter of all the senior citizens in the world. That's what the one-child policy has created. Not just fewer people, but larger numbers of older people and smaller numbers of younger people, too small, in fact, to care for them. Go ahead, Mrs. Burns.
In our group, we were collectively wondering if anywhere in the Providence curriculum, the school goes over humanity tech.
I talk about natural family planning and artificial birth control. I talk about the history behind it sophomore year. Sometimes it comes up junior year, sometimes it doesn't. Then it comes up senior year, usually in that fourth semester as they're getting ready to leave, because we're talking about love and relationship and marriage. And I wouldn't say there's a lot of this, but we have had students, I remember a very sweet girl, good Catholic family, who we were talking about marriage and family, and she said, "My 20s are for me." So in other words, I'm going to sort of live life to the full, and then when I'm like 29, 30 years old, then I guess at that point good for nothing. Then I'll get married. And I pointed out to her, are there advantages to marrying when you're, let's say, older and more mature? I wouldn't want to discount that. But I can say this from the lived experience. I got married when I was 31. And the biggest problem when you're marrying when you're older is you are just so damn selfish. You have had everything your way for a decade, and marriage is about making a life with someone. Please don't misunderstand me. There are advantages to marrying when you're older, especially like if you're attracted to neurotic girls when you're younger. There are advantages to marrying older, but the disadvantage, especially if you have high disposable income, all sorts of experiences that you treasure, independence and freedom. What is it that allows you at 29 to like switch it off? Like, you know, like it's a switch. I'm going to become boring now. So that's where it comes up again. I don't have time to address it now, but let me briefly say, students of this of the era will remember this. I had a junior class that there were four or five very vocal girls who thought Humana Vitae was all wet, was wrong. Mm. And I spent 3 days, three class periods, on Humana Vitae, on the central claims of Humana Vitae. But the problem is that generally they aren't that, there's no skin in the game. So you don't get, that was a very good conversation. It was a very good exchange. But it was because these girls were sort of precocious enough to know what this really meant. Whereas for a lot of kids, it's hard to get traction because they don't understand really what they're signing up for. In other words, they don't understand the modern objections to natural family planning. Let's face it. I mean, the big modern objections are it's just too hard. It's just too much. It's too much work. I'm not sitting there taking my temperature. I'm not sitting there tracking mucus. I'm not doing it. This is just too hard. I'm not doing it. It's once you get to that level that really you can start to get some pushback. I don't know that. There, I get some that it's kind of how different is it really? It was contentious enough that I actually on my board drew up a chart. I drew up an NFP chart because what I wanted to because they wanted to tell me, well, if you're charting and you're abstaining or you're taking birth control, what difference does it make if the result is the same? And I said, if you rob money from a bank or if you go have a job, in both cases you have money, so what difference does it make if the result is the same? It makes all the difference in the world. If I lose weight by watching what I'm eating, maybe getting some more exercise, or if I lose weight by eating whenever I feel like it and just going to the bathroom and making myself throw up, what difference does it make if the result is the same? Obviously, the route, the method you use, you know, establishes whether it's more or not. Go ahead.
But Humana Vitae goes much beyond just, you know, natural family planning. It's really the beauty of sexuality, right?
So Humana Vitae doesn't, no.
Theology of the body.
Theology of the body does. Remember, okay. Paul VI was vilified by his own bishops in writing Humana Vitae. He did it very short, to the point. Here's the teaching. The thing that I do use from Humana Vitae every year with the sophomores is the four predictions out of Humana Vitae. That if you accept contraception, you will see the following things in your society. A lowering of morality. What's the other one? And I give them examples of illegitimacy, the way that's measurable. That the government will use contraceptive policies, sometimes by force, on people. That human beings will become the subject of experiments. And I use embryonic stem cell research. There's one other one. I'm blanking on the fourth one.
Something like the basement of women?
Yeah, that women will be seen as objects. That women will be seen as objects. So I go through that. That I go through every year. And I think that that has some sticking power. Now, by the way, if you want to go to that in depth, the person to read is this guy, Father Stanislas Lestapi. Father Stanislas Lestapi, S.J. He was the one, he was on the Minority Report Commission. Remember when Humana Vitae was called, they got a commission together, hey, study this and get back to me. And the commission got back to the Pope, and unfortunately what they told him is, you know, we think the pill is contraception, but what we should probably just allow contraception anyway. Ah! Poor Paul VI. But there was a minority group in this that said the pill is a contraceptive and you need to renew the ban on contraception, which goes back to the early church. And the arguments that Paul VI makes, those four predictions, he isn't like pulling that out of a hat. They're from Stanislaus Lestepy. He has a book on the church's teaching on contraception, and he has a chapter called The Contraceptive Society. And if you want a kind of disturbing picture of what your society looks like and why, read Stanislaus Lestepy. But I need to circle back. I've said already that the problem, or the disagreement that Catholics and Protestants had about marriage was it being a sacrament. And the difficulty is, if marriage is not a sacrament, then people do not have this supernatural means to be able to keep their marriage together. So what happened as a result of that is that divorce was allowed in the Protestant world. And now that's considered a difference between Protestants and Catholics, is that Protestants allow divorce. Now, for most of Protestant history, you know, divorce was not by any means encouraged. It was severely discouraged, and there was always stigma that came with it. In other words, it's permitted, but we'll probably shun you. But what happened is that once you got into the early part of the 20th century, there became more and more cases that people were sympathetic to, which then allows for more cases and so on. And finally, it got to the point where there was just a kind of a social acceptance of it. And this probably, you know, when my parents, my father's first, he and his first wife, they divorced when I was 3. And about a year later, all of my friends, I had been at their houses, well, my parents were making their new arrangements, then all my friends, all their parents divorced. And I remember talking to Ben Blackhawk and him sharing with me that his parents divorced, this is the early 70s, and it was like 70, 71. He says, that was the same thing in my neighborhood at that same time, 1970, 71, 72. It was like all the families in my neighborhood in Crystal, they all divorced. And we think of that as that's kind of when it became acceptable, that period in the late 60s. But that had been building. That had been building. And again, that's not to say that Protestants, even though they allow it, have an easy acceptance of it. The difficulty is, if there isn't some kind of grace that God is giving you through the marriage, then how could you hold people to a standard that marriage is unbreakable? And if you see a lot of Catholic marriages that just sort of, right, melt down, and you look at this, how is this a fair thing to ask? Again, you've got to go back to, were these people who were living this out as a sacramental marriage? Were these people who were living out as a sacramental marriage? In other words, at a certain point, if God is promising you the graces and the sacrament, and it's not working, you have to ask, well, at what point are people not cooperating with the graces? I mean, where we know the tragedy of marriages that go south, we don't, you know, you don't want to judge, but on the other hand, you have to say at a certain point, if God provides, God makes this possible. If there are graces, God makes it possible. Because the thing is, in this reading, remember, if we can think of this ban on divorce as being sort of Catholic or like traditionally Christian or something like that. But again, from Matthew and from Mark, it's from the words of Jesus himself. Your argument isn't with the Catholic Church or the cardinals or traditional Christian figures. It's right here. And so if we're going to make sense of Jesus doing something that to us seems so drastic as to making marriage unbreakable, which is, in fact, that's how the apostles react. The apostles don't say, hooray, the apostles, how do we get out? Then we have to assume that a loving and merciful God would not give us this restriction, would not make this law, if he were not giving us the graces to live it out. Go ahead.